It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. On October 27, 2018, a gunman killed 11 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Squirrel Hill. The horrific mourning affected the loved ones and friends of the victims, plus those wounded, the members of the three congregations. It also impacted the entire Pittsburgh community. This week, the newly created 1027 Healing Partnership opened its doors to help those directly and indirectly affected. Maggie Feinstein is director of the partnership. Welcome to The Confluence, Maggie.
Thank you, Kevin.
Maggie, nearly a year later, can you assess the frame of mind, the emotional state of people coming through your doors at this point?
Yeah, so we just opened our doors and we are ready to welcome people. And the truth is that it really runs the gamut as far as we can tell of where people are feeling. And this time of year, a lot of people are starting to notice more emotions popping up than before. But that's something that we anticipate and that we welcome in through our doors.
Is it because we're near the one-year mark, or is it especially poignant because we're in the midst of the Jewish High Holy Days, the first since that mass shooting?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. And, you know, the High Holy Days are really a wonderful time for community to gather, but they're also a time of solemn remembrance of a lot of things. And for people this year, it's carrying that special weight. And it's also an opportunity, though, for people to come back together to have hard conversations in familiar places and new places and be able to really think, you know, to sit with those emotions.
You used the word together. How important is that, coming together?
It is so important. I don't think I could overemphasize how important it is to be with people, right? That one of the things, you know, we were started with these 10 amazing community partners of people who wanted to start the 1027 Healing Partnership and partnered with the federal government to be able to do that. And one of those partners is the Center for Victims. And they talk a lot about, in difficult times, a lot of times we pull back, and that the most important thing is to reconnect, to be connected to people. So being together is absolutely one of the most important things. And that is what we hope to be able to accomplish, is that some people naturally have somewhere to come together. Some people, when they're feeling hard emotions, you know, the sadness or the anger or anything else like that, they sometimes pull away. And so we want people to come together in those moments.
Mm-hmm. How have the needs of the community changed since the immediate aftermath of the shooting to now, many months later?
The needs are constantly evolving, you know, and I think that it's needs as much as emotions, as you sort of said at the beginning. The needs right now are all over the map, but a lot of it is just around anticipating for the community what might be coming up for them. In the immediate aftermath, you know, all of us, we're just trying to figure out which end is up. You know, how do we make sense of tomorrow and the next day and the next day? And now it's really about taking stock on connecting with people, taking stock on our own emotions, checking in with ourselves to understand what's true for us today. So things have changed drastically in that way. And one of the things that is really important is that we know they'll continue to change, that's accepted, that's expected, for things to continue to change over time. People, I think, sometimes want to believe that we start one place and we end another, but that's not how emotions work.
Yeah. The 1027 Healing Partnership, that organization, your organization, was established as a result of a long-term planning process by several partners you alluded to. They took their time to assess how they could help the most. What was that process like? Who was involved?
So the partners involved, you know, our federal partners, like I mentioned, from the Office of Victims of Crime, who offered guidance and support through the process as they really come with expertise, which none of us have. And then, you know, in the Jewish community, we have these amazing institutions, right, between our synagogues, as well as the Jewish Community Center, the Jewish Family and Children Community Services, and the Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh. The nice thing is that those three organizations have worked together for such a long period of time, and they were able to kind of come to the table together and balance each other in terms of offering what the community needed. And then locally, we have our Center for Victims, and the Center for Victims has such a long history of doing victim services and really being able to respond in the aftermath of something to this scale, which none of the rest of us could. And then the U.S. Attorney's Office, and like I mentioned, the synagogues, as well as community members. And so all those partners came together. And what's really unusual in Pittsburgh is that they wanted to come together weekly and really show up and have hard conversations to think about how do we best support our community? How do we make sure that we are here for everybody and that we don't let people fall through the cracks?
Our guest on The Confluence is Maggie Feinstein, director of the newly created 1027 Healing Partnership. The space is located in the Jewish Community Center in Squirrel Hill. Is it meant to be a space of comfort for people to gather as a community?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that the space is supposed to be somewhere that people can come if they feel alone or if they're curious or if they want to come together in community, that it is a place where people can come. They can maybe meet somebody new, have a cup of coffee, and be able to express the emotions that they're feeling. The more that we hold them inside, the more they sometimes get bigger. And the more we can connect with somebody, sometimes then we can resolve them ourselves. And the space is designed within the JCC, but it is really not just for JCC members or for even just the Jewish community. It's for people who are feeling those emotions, and we really welcome them in. And our goal is to offer self-directed wellness is what we often call it. But it's the idea that there's not one size that fits all of what people might be looking for when they come through.
So give us an idea of some of the services that will be offered through the Healing Partnership.
So we will offer space for people to come in together and gather. And so we really anticipate that sometimes that means that people will come in and they'll say, you know, I don't really want to talk to somebody. I'd like to be alone. And so we have a wellness space where they can do either an exercise and biofeedback or meditation, guided imagery, anything of that sort, maybe even aromatherapy. And then we have the opportunity, if they would like a one-on-one conversation with somebody who maybe has some mental health background, they can do that. Or they can just sit and have coffee, like I mentioned, or sit by the window and just have casual conversations with other people who are present. Because that connection is so important. Connection is just about seeing and hearing and feeling each other. So a lot of the time, people will probably come in and be there to be together in community.
Mm-hmm. Are some of the formal services, if you would, are they all offered in this space or are they in other locations throughout the community?
So all those agencies that I described that have been doing all the really good work, they have their own facilities. But sometimes for convenience for a family or for a support group, that they will be able to use our space because we all work together in that way. And they bring so much expertise that we will rely on them for that. And we will primarily focus on holding the space for them to continue doing all the great stuff they're doing.
Do you anticipate, maybe even hope, that individuals who come to be alone, trying to find that place of solitude, might discover others who have similar feelings and maybe build bonds and help one another?
Yes, exactly. And I think, you know, for even on the personal level, that since this, I've developed new relationships. I've met new people who are really so incredible and bring so much to my life. And my hope is that this space will allow other people who maybe, you know, are curious or wanting to be able to come in and to be able to also make new community.
Mm-hmm. Community gathering, meeting, but are you also offering services, information, advice, counseling, whatever it is, online?
Yes, absolutely. So our online services, like I said, that self-directed mm-hmm. component means that people sometimes actually do best by doing stuff at home on their time in the evenings. And also the other thing, you know, not just online, but beyond services or beyond holding that community space, in addition, we really want to make sure that we continue to look at ways to be trauma-informed throughout the community as well as sort of victim-centered. And those are two of the key concepts. So sometimes what we'll be doing has nothing to do with services directly for people or with people. It may be about programs that are being offered or language that we use and ways that we can try our best to be sensitive to needs.
You're listening to The Confluence. Our guest is Maggie Feinstein, director of a center created to encourage healing in the wake of the shooting at Tree of Life. Startup funding was provided by the Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh. You also received a grant from the Department of Justice. So you have the financial resources to operate the organization. Does Pittsburgh have the the human expertise to help our friends and neighbors.
Absolutely. It's pretty amazing what we have here. I've been absolutely amazed. You know, we have some of our leaders in trauma-informed therapy services are here in Pittsburgh, and they, you know, national leaders. We have all these very thoughtful and caring neighbors from other communities who have offered things, you know, such as furniture to resources for the center. We have so much human capital in Pittsburgh, and we have an amazing community that wants to continue to contribute in that way.
Mm-hmm. Maggie, how do you prevent re-traumatizing so near the date of the attack?
That's a really good question. I think one of the most important things is to focus on what's true today. Every time we have to go back in time, then we end up back with those same emotions that came at that time. And what's true today for a lot of people are hard emotions, right? Feeling sad or angry. And that doesn't have to be about reliving the experiences we've had. It's really about encouraging people to be with the emotions they feel today, but also the truths of today, right? That that today we finally have no more humidity and sunshine, that's true today. And so we want people to focus on what's true today and to live for that. And even when what's true today is hard, to not go back.
Mm-hmm. Are you anticipating more people, more requests for help as October 27th nears?
Absolutely. And again, it's not as much us helping them as them coming in to help themselves. But yes, I think that, you know, I anticipate seeing more people, and we welcome them, and we welcome that. Mm-hmm. And we want people to know that it's not because there's something wrong with them. It's because they're human, and we want them to please come in.
Mm-hmm. And briefly, the federal grant covers first 3 years of operation. Are you already thinking beyond that? Will the organization remain when the initial capital runs its course?
That's a really good question. And so the design of an organization like this is to meet community need, and community need evolves over time. And so the organization will evolve over time. And so we have no way to know what the future will hold. And that's a very unusual way to start an organization, but it's really important in this situation. And it's one of the reasons why it's sometimes hard to pin down exactly what the work is, because we're waiting for the community to lead us through what the work looks like. And we look forward to opportunities to do that.
Maggie Feinstein is the director of the newly created 1027 Healing Partnership. Maggie, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for your great work.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. International natural gas companies are looking to make homes around Pittsburgh to meet overseas demand for ethane. Competing proposals in Harrisburg could impact childhood immunization exemptions after a measles outbreak affected 38 states, including Pennsylvania. And the race for Allegheny County District Attorney is heating up. What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Email us your suggestions at confluence@wesa.fm. You can find stories, conversations, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Megan Harris. Another alligator has turned up in Pittsburgh. Humane Animal Rescue named the reptile Gus. He's the seventh found this year alone. Two Pennsylvania companies, Yingling and Hershey's Chocolate, are teaming up for a limited edition beer. The chocolate-infused brew will be available on tap later this month. And State Attorney General Josh Shapiro announced this week he's in favor of legalizing recreational marijuana. He joins the governor, lieutenant governor, and auditor general, all Democrats, who are also in favor. For more top stories, go to WESA.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania Speaker of the House Mike Terzai announced yesterday that the State House of Representatives sessions will once again begin with a prayer starting later this month. Joining us to talk about that move is WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief Katie Meyer. Katie, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's go back a little more than a year ago when Middle District Judge halted the policy that barred atheists and other non-believers from giving the opening invocation at the start of each day's session. What happened in that ruling?
So it was interesting. The initial suit had been filed in 2016, and it was from this group of non-believers, this coalition of a couple different organizations like freethinkers and humanists and people like that who wanted to be able to give the invocation. Now, the House has only had a policy about the invocation since 2014 when they first tried to give one. You know, they've always had outside groups come in or outside people come in to give religious invocations, and they come from a variety of different religions, although most, I think, are Catholic and have been historically. So anyway, the humanists and others, they sued, and the judge in that case ruled, and it was a really interesting ruling. It was sort of based on, like, the nature of prayer and how can we define prayer. But basically what he said was you can't discriminate against not only a specific religion or religions, but you also can't discriminate against non-believers. So the House policy was halted after that. House Speaker Mike Terzai is a Republican. He's the one, his office manages the invocations and the speakers. So he's been having lawmakers give the invocations since then. And many of those are religious as well. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where it stood until this other ruling that happened last month.
The Third Circuit Court of Appeals overturned the U.S. District Court ruling. What was the appellate court's reasoning for the overturning?
Again, it was sort of like a nature of prayer thing, which, again, it's funny when they get into this in a legal sense. But that judge basically said the House is within its rights to define prayer as being to a higher power, and that is kind of how it's historically been interpreted. So to have an invocation that's not invoking a god or gods or something like that, the House is allowed to say that they don't want that. So Mike Terzai, you know, they were happy to get this ruling. Terzai is reinstating the no atheists policy now. So when the House comes back into session later this month, the policy will be back in place.
We have just about a minute left. What's been the reaction from lawmakers you've spoken to? Is it a partisan divide on this?
I wouldn't say so necessarily. It's one of those things. I mean, like, listen, the invocation doesn't really matter too much to very many people in terms of lawmaking. It's just like a traditional thing they do at the beginning of the session. But I will say, I think a lot of members, especially younger members who I've kind of talked to about this stuff, have said, you know, they would like to let atheists give the invocation. They don't see why not. The Senate lets non-theists give the invocation. So I talked to Bill Patton, who's the House Democratic spokesman, and he said if they ever, you know, win the majority again, which they intend to eventually, they will revisit the policy.
And very, very briefly, are we expecting an appeal by Americans United for Separation of Church and State?
They haven't filed one yet. I'll keep an eye out, but I don't think we're expecting one.
All right, we'll leave it there. Katie Meyer is WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief. Katie, thanks so much as always.
Thanks, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In addition to bringing up large quantities of oil and gas, the state's fracking boom is vastly increasing the production of ethane, a key resource for the petrochemicals and plastics industries. Shell is building an ethane cracker near Pittsburgh. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports the state is producing so much ethane that some of it is being shipped overseas.
At the top of a hillside on his 200-acre cattle farm in southwestern Pennsylvania, George Watson peers over a well pad on his property and several others nearby.
When you look around here, though, there's wells on about every, not every ridge top, but there's a lot of wells around here. They're scattered everywhere.
Gas has brought problems for Watson. Fights over royalties, dead cattle he blames on toxic spills. Land subsidence and soil erosion he blames on drilling operations. But with all these problems, there's been an upside, too.
Oh, money-wise? Yeah, I got more money than I ever had before. But, you know, I've always sort of been blessed with money. I've been working since I was 5 years old. You know, I've always had money, but not money like I got right now. But I'm making some money off these wells. I wouldn't lie to you about that.
The 9 wells on his property are producing over 1 billion cubic feet of gas a month, according to state records. Most of the gas coming out of these wells is methane, which is sent to fuel power plants, heat homes, and power industrial equipment. But there are also other gases coming out of these wells. These include a gas called ethane. Ethane is a raw ingredient in petrochemicals and plastics. And not far from here, Shell is building a chemical plant to convert some of the region's ethane into plastic. But there's so much of it coming out of the ground right now that chemical plants in the U.S. can't use it all. So companies are shipping some of this ethane to chemical plants in China, India, and Europe.
If we weren't exporting ethane right now, they'd be giving it away for free.
Steve McGinn is an editor for the chemical trade publisher ICIS. He says ethane is the base for a broad array of plastics and chemicals, everything from plastic bottles to clothing to medicine.
And all these plastics and all these fibers and everything basically comes from ethane.
And there's more ethane in the U.S. than ever. The fracking boom has doubled the amount of oil and gas the U.S. produces in the last decade, but it's also allowed companies to tap into rock deposits like shales, which are high in what are called natural gas liquids, a group that includes ethane. Warren Vilchevsky is an economist at the U.S. Energy Information Administration.
The gas that's produced from these shale formations is significantly richer in natural gas liquids than conventional gas would be.
In 2011, the Switzerland-based chemical company INEOS began looking for a new ethane supply for its chemical plants in Europe. Vilchevsky says those plants were relying on the declining North Sea oil fields.
So INEOS looked at the United States, where ethane supply was growing and where, especially in the Appalachian region, that ethane had like no place to go, and they recognized an opportunity.
INEOS officials did not agree to an interview for this story, but in a company video, CEO Jim Radcliffe says importing cheap American shale gas was necessary to save the company's European chemical plants.
I think for some of these assets in Europe, it's the only way they can survive if we can bring some of the US economics across to Europe to feed these big assets that we've got over here.
INEOS commissioned a fleet of ships to carry ethane across the Atlantic from a port near Philadelphia to its plants in the UK and Norway. But before it could do that, it had to get the gas from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia. To bring the gas across Pennsylvania, Sunoco Logistics is building the Mariner East Pipeline Project through the southern part of the state. But the plan has been controversial. Construction resulted in dozens of spills and complaints of water contamination. Also, Pennsylvania allowed Sunoco to use eminent domain to build the pipeline across the properties of dozens of landowners. One of these property owners was Ellen Gerhart, who wanted to keep her property forested. In 2016, a chainsaw crew cut down a grove of trees on her property to make way for the pipeline. Eminent domain is usually used for projects that will benefit the public. But Gerhart thought a pipeline that sends Marcellus shale gas to overseas chemical plants did not fit that description.
It's not carrying anything that can be used for home fuels or vehicle fueling, anything like that. It's all going to Marcus Hook.
Marcus Hook is the port near Philadelphia where INEOS is putting ethane onto ships bound for Europe. In 2016, the first ships carrying ethane from Marcus Hook arrived in Scotland.
It is the first delivery for INEOS of shale gas into the UK. It's arriving at Grangemouth later this morning and just at the moment going under the two and a bit bridges, three almost bridges.
All of this starts on land like George Watson's in Pennsylvania and ends in places like the INEOS plant in Grangemouth, Scotland. In a 2016 video produced by the company, plant manager Kenneth Stevenson said he was excited about getting the new supply of shale gas.
Oh yes, definitely. People are looking forward to doing their job fully to the capacity of what the plant can produce.
Kevin Ross has seen the increased activity at the INEOS Grangemouth plant firsthand. He's president of the Scottish Plastics and Rubber Association and has a plastics company near the Grangemouth plant.
I can't underestimate the importance of the American shale gas and the feedstock costs for INEOS. It is driving investment decisions into Grangemouth, which wouldn't have been made if it wasn't for the availability of the shale gas.
Experts say ethane exports are only going to continue. There's just so much ethane in the U.S. in places like the Marcellus Shale, and other countries want it. Reed Fraser, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When students returned to school about 5 weeks ago, the debate over mandatory immunization bubbled up again, especially with parts of the nation facing their worst measles outbreaks in a generation. That, according to the CDC. People in 31 states, including Pennsylvania, have been infected. Now there are a handful of bills that would either eliminate exemptions or strengthen them for required immunization in the Commonwealth. Joining us on the line is Erica DeVald, the Director of Advocacy for Vaccinate Your Family. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Erica, according to the World Health Organization, the U.S. eradicated measles in 2000, but the country could lose its elimination status for measles. What beyond the outbreaks earlier this year would now cause that loss of status?
So the loss of status is the fact that we have continued to have outbreaks. So the outbreak that I'm sure everyone's seen in the news originating out of New York City, particularly in Brooklyn, has continued. It's spread to Rockland County, New York. It's spread to Detroit, Michigan, down to Baltimore. And they were unable to stop that outbreak. If an outbreak of measles cannot be stopped within a year, it is once again considered sort of native, if you will, to the United States again. Luckily, they stopped the New York outbreak 2 weeks ago, so just in time to save that elimination status.
Mm-hmm. Would that have been a symbolic loss, or are there practical repercussions if the status is lost?
You know, really, it's a little bit of both. If we lost elimination status, it doesn't mean that we all need to panic that we're all going to get measles. You know, most of us did receive our vaccinations. And if you look at the vaccination rate across the country and even across the state of Pennsylvania, vaccination rates remain high. The problem is a national rate, even a state or county level rate, doesn't really tell you your risk. You have to go into individual communities and school by school and look at those vaccination rates to see if there are people who are susceptible in the case of an outbreak.
Measles, how long can someone be contagious? In other words, if someone was infected during the outbreak earlier this year, can they still spread it now?
No. So measles is exquisitely contagious in that not only are you contagious for 4 days before you show symptoms, but your breath is contagious. And your breath can stay in the air for 2 hours after you've left a room. So if I were infected with measles, didn't know it yet because I've not yet had the telltale rash, I go to a grocery store, I've breathed in the grocery store. Anybody who enters that space and breathes that air for 2 hours could get measles. And because it is so infectious, 90% of people who are not vaccinated against it can get it. But you are only contagious then for another 4 days after the rash has appeared.
Because of those close confines, shall we say, are school and health officials keeping a close eye on students in these early weeks of the school year?
Oh, absolutely. Especially, I mean, measles is a little bit of a seasonal disease, you know, just as we think of fall and flu and winter as flu season. It also is traditionally measles season. So part of the concerns of CDC and WHO was if New York wasn't able to stop that outbreak over the summer, we would see an uptick of cases again in the fall. So, you know, school and health officials are always vigilant about these diseases, but particularly at this season.
Pennsylvania is still technically in an outbreak. State health officials have confirmed at least 2 cases of measles in September in York County. Erica, aren't most of the U.S.'s previous cases related to patient zero, you know, someone who came from another country or who traveled abroad and then came back to the U.S. with the disease?
Absolutely. And that's what's happened in New York. It was a woman who went abroad and came back. She was vaccinated. She thought that she was immune to measles, but we know vaccines are not always 100% effective. And so she actually contracted the disease and brought it back to York. And the same thing happened in Pittsburgh at the beginning of the year. It was 2 separate incidences, someone who traveled overseas and brought it back to Pittsburgh. And then a family who was visiting other family from overseas brought it to Pittsburgh as well.
Are we getting any cases sort of originating domestically?
No. So that is when we would lose our elimination status. So that's what we would have seen at a year. At a certain point, so many people would become infected with measles vaccine that we're just transmitting it from person to person within the United States and don't need anyone bringing a new case in from outside of our borders. Mm-hmm.
Our guest on The Confluence is Erica Duvald, the Director of Advocacy for Vaccinate Your Family. The measles outbreak has led to several states re-examining their exemptions for mandatory vaccinations. Erica, are Pennsylvania's exemptions similar to those in other states?
Yes and no. There are many other states that have what we have, which is philosophical and religious exemptions. All 50 states have medical exemptions. If for any reason you can't be vaccinated for medical reasons, you should not have to get a vaccine. That's common across all 50 states. Other states, some have religious, some have philosophical. It's really in how the legislation is written. Here in Pennsylvania, we don't have a lot of requirements for obtaining a religious or a philosophical exemption. If you don't want your kid to be vaccinated, your kid doesn't have to be vaccinated. There's not even a standardized form.
There are a few very different bills pending in the Pennsylvania legislature. One in the Senate, sponsored by Dalen Leach of Montgomery County, would eliminate the religious and philosophical exemptions from the mandatory vaccinations. So that would require more people to be immunized. Are the religious exemptions difficult to remove considering the constitutional protections for religion?
Not at all. So all organized religions support vaccination. If you look at doctrines from the Vatican, if you look at statements from the Jewish faiths, from various sects of Christianity, Islam, etc., nobody is opposed to vaccination. Religions actually very much support vaccination.
Mm-hmm. Another on the complete opposite end, a bill sponsored by Representative Daryl Metcalf of Butler County, it would limit what doctors could do to encourage vaccination and would even bar doctors from requiring parents to sign a liability waiver for refusing to immunizing their children. Is this reinforcing an individual's rights?
The language in the Metcalf bill is a bit troubling. It is all in the eye of the beholder of how aggressive, quote unquote, a doctor is being in recommending vaccination. I mean, remember, we know vaccines to be safe and effective and the best way to protect ourselves, our children, our communities against these really dangerous vaccine preventable diseases. And so to tell a doctor to not do their best in sharing what is best for the child is a very slippery slope.
Do you think this bill could go far? I mean, since the Supreme Court, I believe it was 1905, ruled that states have the authority to protect the public from infectious diseases, even at the cost of personal freedom.
You know, anything could happen. I don't see the Metcalf bill going very far. I don't believe a committee has picked it up and has listened to it. On the tightening exemption side, I imagine we could see something move forward. I don't know that the state of Pennsylvania is ready to eliminate non-medical exemptions, but we could certainly make some strides forward, even something as simple as a standardized form. It makes it easier on the schools to evaluate these exemptions.
What's happening in other states, maybe New York, for example, where we've had that outbreak, the big outbreak regarding legislation.
And I'm sure many of the listeners have seen the news coming out of New York. So this past year, two states, New York and Maine, have eliminated their non-medical exemptions. In New York, they moved a little bit more quickly because of the outbreak, and they needed to get kids vaccinated before this school year. So it was passed this summer. And it was implemented for this fall. So kids are being barred from school right now if they're not up to date in their immunizations. Whereas Maine's given a little bit more leeway. Parents don't have to have their kids vaccinated until next school year. And then in California, a couple of years ago, California eliminated their non-medical exemptions. And just this past year, they refined the medical exemption process so that it's easier for schools to understand whether they're looking at a legitimate medical exemption or not.
In our last 30 seconds, what do you tell parents whose religious convictions cause them to forego the immunization, or they actually have fears the vaccines themselves can cause medical problems? Should their kids be barred from school?
You know, it is understandable that people have concerns about vaccines. There's a lot of misinformation online. Take your time to talk to your doctor, talk to your healthcare provider, and really look at it the way we look at drunk driving. Yes, it is your right to get drunk, but no, it is not your right to get behind a wheel and put others at risk. So in the same way, yes, you can choose not to vaccinate your child, but we ask you, please don't put that child in a school where they can put others at risk.
Erica DeWald is the Director of Advocacy for Vaccinate Your Family. Thanks so much, Erica.
Thank you so much.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Monday is the deadline to register to be able to vote in next month's general election. It's the so-called off-your-election municipal, county, some judicial races. But Chris Potter, the editor of WESA's government accountability team, can always find some interesting contents. He joins us now. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Kevin.
All right. So what's on the ballot that particularly piques your interest?
Well, you know, the top of the ballot is not going to be so fascinating. There's a couple of statewide superior court races, county executive, county controller, district attorney. A lot of races there's not a lot of interest in. The county executive race is kind of a foregone conclusion. The district attorney's race is interesting. Stephen Zappala, who is not used to having much of a challenger, has a very spirited challenger in independent Lisa Middleman. She's raised a bunch of issues with respect to how he's kind of conducted that office over the past two decades. She's up against this challenge, though, which is that I've been told something like half of the people who vote in these elections in an off-year municipal in Allegheny County just pull the straight party ticket lever. And Steve Zappala is on both the Democrat and the Republican side. So she'd really have to pull every other voter who wasn't pulling those things to have a shot.
And it's not easy to defeat about a 20-year incumbent.
Two decades. Yeah. The one thing she's got going for her is there's sort of been some interest in some national publications about some of the ways in which he's conducted that office. He's prosecuted some low-level drug offenders. There's been some reporting about sort of a cozy relationship between his office and insurance companies and how they pursue insurance fraud. And of course, we have, as my colleague Anlie Herring is reporting today, we have this story about people having concerns with his charging decisions in this Exxon gas station assault.
Yes. Some customers were assaulted and a couple of people have been charged, but not as, shall we say, vigorously as some folks would like.
Yeah, they've been charged with simple assault, which is a misdemeanor. Some people have been calling for aggravated assault, which is a felony because of what they've seen on video that's been circulated on social media.
All right. There's a ballot question for city voters. Basically, do you want to increase your own real estate taxes to help fund parks? But there's a statewide ballot question.
Yeah.
What would that do?
So that's called Marcy's Law, and it's essentially a vote. We'll be having more reporting about this in the weeks ahead. But it's essentially would amend the Constitution to specify the rights of crime victims to be some of these things would sort of seem not terribly controversial and already exist to some extent in state law. Notification provisions about when there's court proceedings or whatever. Some of the ideas are more controversial, though. The ACLU and some others have raised concerns that you got to be careful in giving rights to victims that you don't sort of infringe on the rights of those who are accused. One of the provisions, for example, would basically say you don't have to be deposed by an accused person's lawyer if you don't want to, because that would be upsetting and traumatizing. The problem there, of course, is how do you put on a defense if you can't, you know, if you can't talk to interview the people who were, you know, integral, who were part of the crime. Mm-hmm. So there's some very difficult questions there to be answered, and we'll see if they even get asked in the next few weeks.
All right. You mentioned the DA's race, but are any of the races even somewhat competitive?
You know, as I say, there are challengers for county executive, county controller. There just hasn't been much going on there. Matt Drozd, who's running against Rich Fitzgerald, his major campaign platform seems to be, I will stand out alongside a road with a sign as commuters drive by. Not a lot going on there. There are a couple of interesting races at the county council level as a part-time legislative body. A few of those races are being challenged in the South Hills and the western suburbs in particular. And it's sort of interesting because county council just last month voted against an effort to create a police civilian review board. A couple of the no votes who helped defeat that proposal are now up. So the way these are, depending on how this election shakes out, we could have a very different county council majority on that and other issues.
I noticed there are a couple of independent candidates running for city council this November. What's going on there?
Yeah. So in District 1 and in District 9, there are multiple candidates facing the incumbents. You know, I think there's a few things going on. One is a sort of discontent. We see it at the national level with politics as usual, but also at the local level, too, with people feeling like, you know, these Democrats, the Democratic nominating process, the Democratic primary is a foregone conclusion. We still feel like these candidates need to be challenged. The problem is you got multiple candidates running. They're going to split that opposition vote. And the problem of living in a one-party town, which Pittsburgh is there's really no mechanism to sort of cull the herd there and kind of pick a champion to go up against that person. There just isn't something like that in Pittsburgh, and it makes it difficult to challenge even when there's clearly an interest in doing so.
All right. And if you want to get in on all this excitement, time's running out.
That's right. Get ahead of the 2020 election rush, folks. Get yourself registered now if you haven't already. Yeah, this is there are a number of ways to do this. The deadline, as I think you said at the top, is Monday. You can go to your elections office. That's at the county elections building on the county office building on Ross Street downtown. Do that by Monday. You can also send in a ballot as long as it's postmarked by Monday, or you can go online. This is a new innovation here. The easiest way to do it, just type in PA online voter registration. The first result you'll get will be PA voter services. You can take care of that now and be set for this November.
Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Government Accountability Team. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, assistance from Christopher Stubbs. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.